Olivet Discourse, Part 1. The first talk in a series on the Olivet Discourse, in Matthew 24 and 25, was presented by Ron Julian on June 30, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
What I thought I would do tonight, and I hope this will fly with us here, but we never really got a chance to talk about together about the last discourse, last of the big discourses in Matthew, the Olivet Discourse, where Jesus talks about his return. This will be a little different than the kind of things we've been talking about recently, but here's the spot that I find myself in, and this is why I want to take just tonight and talk about this a little bit. I don't know if you ever turn on the television and watch those shows like This Week in Bible Prophecy, or Jack Van Impe has his show where if you've ever seen a guy, he's rattling off Bible verses faster than you can take them in. That's Jack Van Impe. I find myself torn when I watch those shows because, on the one hand, I'm very interested in what they're talking about because I really do believe that the focus of our lives as believers is the hope that we are counting on and waiting for at the return of Christ. So the second coming of Christ ought to be a topic, in one sense, that's very interesting to us because that's ultimately the focus of our lives. That's when this thing really gets going. Last week, or the last couple of weeks ago when I was teaching, somebody asked me afterwards, we were talking in Romans 5 about the hope of glory that we see in there, and somebody came up afterwards and was talking to me and saying, you know, I find that that everything you said made sense to me, but I don't find myself thinking a whole lot about this hope. You know, I don't find myself focusing a great deal on the future and where that's going to go. And as we talked a little bit, we sort of came to realize that the perception that this person had, which I think is many of us can often have about the return of Christ, is that essentially what I'm waiting for is that day when, you know, we live in a great place with streets of gold and that everything is kind of luxurious. I'm waiting for this day when everything gets really, really neat and groovy, I guess. And my explanation to him of what I think the Bible is talking about, when, for instance, when we saw in Peter talking about how we should fix our hope completely on the grace to be revealed to us when Jesus returns, is that it's not talking so much in terms of streets of gold and, you know, feeling great and having bodies that can walk through walls or whatever your picture is of how that works. The fact is that the Bible, in many significant ways, is telling us that we have not yet been saved. That salvation is something that hasn't really happened yet. There's a sense in which it has. Sometimes the Bible talks about salvation as something that has been accomplished for us. Jesus' death has brought us forgiveness and reconciliation with God, and that is not nothing. I mean, that's everything in a sense. But there's another sense in which the Bible often talks about salvation as something yet to be accomplished. Peter talks about it in those terms. If we think about it in those terms, are you saved? No. That means that in some sense, I still stand in need of rescue. I'm in trouble. Things are bad for me, and I need to be rescued from my situation. Well, in those terms then, what we come to understand is that the second coming of Christ is that day when I am finally rescued from my situation, from the problem of death, from the problem of sin, from the futility of this existence, from the pain and hurt of this existence that I bring on myself because of my own selfishness and evil. I mean, that rescue is what we're waiting for. If we think about it in those terms, then we can understand, then, on the one hand, why the second coming of Christ ought to be profoundly interesting to us. The focus of my existence is that is the day I am looking for when I am finally saved. But, on the other hand, I have this problem with these shows that I was telling you about, is that I don't find myself agreeing with a whole lot of what they talk about in terms of how it's going to happen. And I mean, in the section that we're going to look at here, the Olivet Discourse, people pull out things. There's talk about earthquakes and wars, and so we have a lot of stories about, you know, there's more earthquakes in the last 10 years than have been recorded. And now that means that Jesus is just about ready to come back, or, you know, there are more wars going on, or... you know, we'll pull something out of Revelation about things on foreheads and hands and have big stories about scanners in supermarkets, you know, about how the technology is getting to where all you've got to do is stick your hand in there, and that means that Jesus is just about ready to come back. And from my perspective, these are not very biblically convincing arguments. I don't find myself convinced that they've understood the Scriptures very well when they're presenting this stuff. So I'm kind of torn, where I want to be interested in what they're saying because they're talking about the hope of my life, and yet it's mostly kind of trivial what they talk about when it comes right down to it. So I think it's helpful. I mean, I don't have the answers when it comes to all of the ins and outs of the Old Testament prophets, of the passages in the New Testament that deal with eschatology, especially with the book of Revelation. There are many difficulties there. But it seems to me that it would be helpful for us to try to get a handle on what is a reasonable way of approaching these questions. So I've looked at the Olivet Discourse for a number of years at various times, and I think I have a basic understanding of what's happening there, which I'm sure many of you might be prepared to disagree with. But I think I see what's happening there, and what I want to do is just kind of lay it out for you and give you what I think is a healthy framework, a healthy way of thinking about how these kinds of passages work. Okay, so if this is not a real interesting topic to you, bear with me. What I want to do is give us a framework, give us a place to stand as we're thinking about these questions. Ultimately, I don't think the important thing for us is to figure out when Jesus is coming back. I don't actually think that's possible at any rate. But what I would like us to do is to approach these passages, which are important teaching passages, to approach them and let them speak for themselves as best we can. To not come with to them and impose our own questions on them, but let these passages speak to us about the questions that they set out to answer. The Olivet Discourse is a good example of this, because most of the teaching that I know from this passage, and we'll be in Matthew 24 here as we look at this, most of the teaching from this passage, I think, is pretty much off the mark, because it is asking questions of the passage that the passage did not set out to answer. So let's start in Matthew 24. And Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he answered and said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down." So the situation is, I believe, that Jesus has been saying things to suggest that there's coming a time when things are going to be disrupted and the temple might not be standing. And I think when the disciples are pointing out the temple to him, part of their motivation is to kind of imply, look, this is a big deal. This is a big, fancy, wonderful temple. Isn't God going to kind of make this the focus of everything? Isn't this going to be the the great thing someday. And Jesus tells them basically, you look at that great temple there, there's a day coming when the whole thing is going to be torn down. And the day that he's talking about happened within another generation of when he was talking. The Romans came into Jerusalem. There was an uprising, the Jews trying to basically fight the Roman occupation, and the Romans sent in their big guns and leveled the place. And it was at that time when the state of Israel, or Judea as a political entity, ceased to exist. They ripped the place apart, and the Jews were scattered to the four winds. So that's what Jesus is talking about. That's the day he's predicting. The temple itself, it was literally true that not one stone would be left upon another. And it was a pretty amazing thing to say, because these were big stones that made up this temple. And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" What's important, if we're going to understand this passage and what it has to teach and what it has to say to us as well as to the disciples, we have to understand what is the question that Jesus is about to answer. From my perspective, this is everything. This tells us what it is that Jesus is about to do. The question that he was asked was, when will these things be? And what were the things that he was talking about? It was the destruction of the temple that he just described. He says basically this huge temple building is going to be entirely torn down, not one stone standing upon another. And so they're asking him, when is that going to be? But together with that question, they say, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, actually, that part of the question only shows up in Matthew. If we look in Mark and Luke, like the question we see in Luke, for instance, they just say, "Teacher, when therefore will these things be, and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place?" So, in the other synoptic accounts, basically all they're asking about is, that we're told about there, is, when's that going to happen? You just talked about the temple being torn apart. When is that going to happen? And what's the sign that that is going to occur? Matthew makes it clear that the disciples had in their mind such a cataclysmic event, the destruction of the temple then, must be connected with the institution of the kingdom of God, that Jesus would come in power, that he would come and make his claim on the throne of Israel, and that the age would end and the new age would begin. So they, in their mind, have connected the destruction of the temple with the final things, the end of the age. So you can see that in their mind, it's not too surprising. Jesus is there. They understand that he is the Messiah, and they know that the Messiah is going to rule over this great kingdom one day. They have this expectation that this whole thing probably is going to happen pretty soon. If the temple's going to be destroyed, okay, great. The temple's going to be destroyed, the kingdom's going to happen, it's all going to happen real quick here, right? So tell us, what's the sign this is going to happen, and how is this all going to go down? So I think the first thing that Jesus does is lets them know that rather than a quick end to the troubles of this age, that they can expect a period of time to happen where difficulties are going to continue and things are going to go on as they have gone on. That's starting in verse 4. He says, Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no one misleads you. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will mislead many. And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place, but that is not yet the end. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs." I don't think that we're in this that section there that we're being invited to picture that somehow just before Jesus comes back, there's going to be a great increase in wars and earthquakes. He's speaking to the disciples, to their question, how soon is this stuff going to happen? And he's basically saying to them, look, things are going to go on as you have been aware of them going on. Wars will continue, earthquakes, nation will rise against kingdom, nation, kingdom against kingdom, just as they have known in the past. I mean, this is not news. This is the way things have gone always. And he's saying, this is going to continue, but don't get the idea that this is the end. It is not the end. Okay, so he goes on. What we need to understand, I think, when we look at that is, first of all, I don't know how many times you've seen those shows or the books that say, because there are more earthquakes or there are more wars or something, that means that it must be time for Jesus to come back. I don't think there's anything in what Jesus is saying that implies that that's the case. He was telling the disciples at their time, as they were looking to see what was going to happen, that they would see wars and earthquakes and famines and all of that, that the kingdom of God was not going to sweep in and do away with all of that right away. That was, in fact, those things were going to continue on. And we have seen those things. The disciples saw them, and over the past 2,000 years, those things have gone on as they always have gone on. I think that's the sort of thing that Jesus is saying. He's not giving it as a sign of his coming so much as he's just preparing them for the fact that this is the way things are going to happen. We have to remember, from their perspective, it would have been very natural to think, well, Jesus is here, so this is all going to just wrap up, like maybe next week? You know, I mean, why not? I mean, he's talking to them after he has entered triumphantly into Jerusalem on the donkey, and the crowds have been yelling, Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. I mean, Jesus has accepted the accolade of the crowd as the Messiah. He's basically said, yeah, that's me. When the Pharisees said, rebuke your disciples to Jesus, because they were basically calling out to him as if he were the conquering, entering Messiah into Jerusalem, you remember he said, If they were to be quiet, the stones would cry out. I mean, he's saying basically, look, they're right. I am the king entering into my city, and there's nothing wrong in them treating me that way because that's who I am. So the disciples have been through all that. It's not at all surprising that they would think, well, so this is about to wrap up, right? I mean, we're all ready to go. Now he says, then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you. And you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. And at that time many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. And in the parallel passages, we see more of his talk about how they will stand before governors and kings as a testimony, and the Spirit will give them what they're going to say, and so on. All of which we see described in the book of Acts. I mean, the Jesus' disciples, instead of Jesus coming and immediately bringing in the kingdom of God and all of their troubles are over, instead he's warning them, look, no, there's going to be a period of time here and you're going to have a great deal of tribulation and suffering to go through. You're going to stand before kings. The Spirit is going to tell you what to say. I mean, when we think of Peter and Paul and the martyrdom of Stephen and all of the things that we see in Acts, there's the beginning, the fleshing out of what Jesus had promised them here in this discussion. So again, he's not talking about the things that are going to happen just right before he comes back. He's telling them, don't get the idea that this is going to happen real quickly. This is what you can expect. This kind of suffering, these kind of difficulties, this is what you're going to undergo in my name. Likewise, well, oh, that's right, I'll leave that comment out. Okay, now, what was the question that they set out to ask? What did they want to know? The primary question they asked is, you just talked about the temple being ripped to bits. When is that going to happen? And what is the sign that that's going to happen? Now we get to Jesus' answer to that question. Having said, in general, don't get the idea that the kingdom is going to come immediately and an end to all your troubles is about to happen. Instead, there are going to be wars, and you, my disciples, are going to suffer and go before kings and so on. Now let me answer your question about the destruction of the temple. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. And let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. Now, what do we do with this? It is very common. In my young days as a Christian, I was very interested in a foolish and very unbiblical way in the second coming of Christ. I've told people this before. I had a binder with charts and things that I was making. You know, I was going to figure out exactly when this was going to happen and how it was all going to work. And one of the best things that happened to me in those early days was finally realizing that I was being a fool and just leaving that behind and abandoning that question for a while. Because I was doing exactly what I was seeing modeled all around me. Just grabbing verses here and there without paying any attention to the context or what the books were talking about and pasting them together into this model of what was going to happen. At that time, when I was reading a lot about this stuff, I think almost universally in the books that I was reading, this passage was used to say, okay, now there's a picture for us of what it is that we're waiting for to happen. We know that the temple is going to have to be rebuilt in Jerusalem now that the Jews are back there, because it says that the abomination of desolation is going to be standing in the holy place. And this is going to be happening during the Great Tribulation, which we know, of course, because we've been told that it's a 7-year period that happens sometime before Jesus comes back. And so this whole section is used to describe to us, this is what we're waiting for, this is what we'll be seeing happening. There will be this Antichrist figure who will stand in the temple and there will be this great tribulation and so on. The problem is, this is my main point that I want to make about this passage. If this is talking about the coming of the Antichrist in our future, then when did Jesus answer the question that they asked him about the destruction of the temple? I would argue that he answered their question about the destruction of the temple right here in this section. And if that's the case, then this is not a description of the Antichrist someday in our future, but this is a description of the destruction of the temple when the Roman armies went into the Holy of Holies and destroyed the temple of God. Now, if that's the case, then it's not giving us much information about what's happening in our future. But my argument would be that it's more important for us to know what the text is really saying than to, even though it may not seem as relevant. I mean, if that's true, then I don't know a whole lot about what's going to happen. Maybe there's not going to be a temple rebuilt in Jerusalem, because this passage is not demanding that. This has already happened, from my perspective. Jesus is asked the question, when is this going to happen? When are these things going to take place? And what's the sign that they're going to happen? We see the question in Mark and Luke. And his answer in each place is, look, when you see these things happening, when you see the beginning of this, then recognize that what I have predicted is about to happen. It's especially clear if you read in Luke. Luke is one who did a lot of research on what it was that Jesus taught and said. And I suspect that what happened is that Luke recognized that there are some parts of what Jesus had said as he talked to the disciples about all this stuff that didn't make it into the account in Mark and Matthew. So he spells it out a little bit in a way that we don't see in the other two accounts. He says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. and then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and so on. And he concludes by saying, there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. Well, that's very clear. That's exactly what happened in 70 AD. The armies surrounded Jerusalem. The city fell by the edge of the sword. The people were led captive, led out into all the nations, and Jerusalem was trampled underfoot by the Gentiles. I think it's very clear that that's what he's talking about. So they asked the question, when is it that this is going to happen? And here's his explanation. Now, there's a couple of things that people would point to, though, that they would say, well, that's a little bit problematic, Ron, because, first of all, he talks about a great tribulation such has not occurred since the beginning of the world, nor ever shall. And are we saying that what happened in 70 AD in Jerusalem is the worst thing that ever happened in the history of the world? What about the Holocaust? Wasn't the Holocaust worse for the Jews than what happened under the Romans? And then the other point that would be made is that a little later here in Matthew, he says, immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the sign of the Son of Man appears in the sky. If Jesus' return is immediately after the tribulation of those days, then doesn't that have to mean that this tribulation that's being talked about is something that's in our future? Because Jesus didn't come back immediately after the Jerusalem was destroyed. There's a couple of things I think we can say to that. First of all, I think we have to think about this great tribulation that Jesus is talking about in terms of what he's describing. Remember the history of the Jews. These are the people of God who had been promised. Abraham, the founder of this nation, had been promised this land where his descendants would live in peace and God would be their God. And what had happened to Israel over the many years? They had been slaves in Egypt. They finally make it into the land. While they're in there, they were often rebellious and disobedient and were punished by God because of that. David became king finally, and Solomon, and they had a brief sort of period of prosperity, followed by a reign of kings, many of whom were rebellious and evil people, which ended in God sending the Babylonians into the place and taking them into captivity for 70 years. So there was this terrible event when the enemies of God's people came in and destroyed the place. And yet 70 years later, God brought them back. And there was a period of time when they sort of got things back together, and they had a kingdom of sorts and prosperity of sorts and independence of sorts, only to be finally conquered by the Romans. We're not even talking about in after they were under the Babylonians, then they went to the Persians, and from the Persians to the Greeks, and from the Greeks to the Romans. Most of that period of time was a time of conquest by somebody else. So now, here we are, the people of God, the promised nation of God, living in the land, under the yoke of the Romans. And Jesus, their Messiah, is saying, basically, that instead of the coming of the Messiah bringing, finally, relief to the people of God, that is the Jews, those who had these promises from him. Instead, what was going to happen was that the Romans were going to come into the place and in such numbers and cause such suffering and havoc that basically, if you think about all of the things that had happened to Israel up to that point, there was nothing worse than this. And in fact, in a sense, I think, however you think about the tribulation, the Holocaust is kind of just, that's a part of the fallout of what happened when the Romans came in and took away the lives of many of the Jews and their nation, and they as Luke describes it, you will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled under until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. For 2,000 years, the Jews, the people of God, the descendants of Abraham, those who had been promised a place because they were Abraham's descendants, had no place. The captivity under the Babylonians was nothing compared to what happened to them here. And if you read the accounts in Josephus, the events themselves were truly horrific for the Jews. In the city of Jerusalem, it was under siege. There was no food, and it literally got to the point where, Josephus describes things like mothers eating their children, and horrible, horrible things. This really was in the life of the nation of Israel, the people of God. This was that decisive moment when all of the corrections and judgments that God had brought upon that nation over the years came to a focus in the destruction that came upon them by the Romans. So now I have toyed with the idea back and forth that the great tribulation that Jesus described actually could be seen as extending over the whole period from when the city was destroyed by the Romans until now. And I'm not sure about that. Sometimes I think that's a good idea, sometimes not. But it doesn't really matter, I think, ultimately. What I'm saying, though, is that if we understand in the history, in salvation history, in the history of the Jews as the distinctive people of God, this was the worst. This was that place where their enemies triumphed over them in a way that had never happened that way before, with such suffering and such an impact on their nation. For 2,000 years, they were gone. They had no place to be. The abomination of desolation that he describes, spoken of through Daniel the prophet, many people try to connect up passages in Daniel and say, see, here's a picture of the Antichrist that we can expect in the future. And here Jesus is referring to that Antichrist, so we know that this is something that's in our future. But again, if you go back and look at those passages in Daniel, which we won't do tonight, I would argue that you see different events described in Daniel. You see the destruction that was brought about by Antiochus Epiphanes at a certain crucial point in the history of the Jews. You see the conquest under Alexander pictured. I would argue that there is a picture there of the destruction that came upon the Jews under the Romans in 70 AD. And I think that there is a place in Daniel that ultimately talks about some things that are in our future and pictures a destruction that is yet to be. But I would argue, if we were to go and look at all of Daniel, that the abomination of desolation that Jesus is talking about here, number one, he may just mean, since there are several different abominations of desolation that are pictured in Daniel, that he may just mean, the kind of desolating sacrilege that you see in Daniel, which is someone going into the temple, a Gentile going into the temple, tearing it down and desecrating it. But even if he means a particular thing that Daniel is talking about, I think there's a passage in Daniel that we could point to and say, this is the passage that Jesus has in mind. And that what he's suggesting is that this destruction under the Romans is what Daniel had seen in one of the visions that he was given. We could spend a lot of time talking about Daniel, and I could explain to you all the things I don't know about what's happening in Daniel, but at this point, I would argue that his language there, the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, can easily and very naturally be applied to the destruction that happened under the Romans when Titus and his armies came in. Okay. Let me ask at this point, There's some more in the passage that I want to talk about, but let me ask at this point if you have any questions or comments. Am I making any sense? Are you seeing what I'm getting at, Logan?
Get what you're saying. Just give me the picture of the end will be just like it's always been. If he uses, I mean, in that one passage he talks about, like, the days of Noah, they were marrying.
Right, right, right.
And now people look at the divorce rate.
Right, right.
What vision did they have that this may have been correct? Did they believe that right before the Messiah would come, all wars would stop? I mean, did they have this belief in a peaceful period that ushered in the kingdom?
No, I think that the picture they had is that, I mean, Jesus having entered triumphantly into Jerusalem, that essentially the kingdom of God was about to happen, and that when it came, wars and famines and all of that was going to be eliminated. So the picture that they had was a picture of that they were standing right on the doorway. I mean, any day now, all of the suffering of mankind is going to be done with because the kingdom of God is about to enter into history in its fullness. Notice when we get to chapter 25 of Matthew right after this, Jesus has three parables. Well, there's really four parables in the end of 24 and 25. Each of them having to do with this idea of someone going away for a long time and people having to deal with that fact. And I think the reason he's telling those stories is because they're not prepared for the idea that he is about to leave. I mean, having arrived and entered triumphantly into Jerusalem, that he's going to leave and leave the world in essentially the shape that it already is. I mean, he's basically talking about, in those stories, about how in one way or another, Jesus' followers have to be prepared for the fact that he's not going to be here. Well, that's not hard for us to think about because 2,000 years later, we know that he hasn't been around in the personal bodily form for a long time. I mean, there isn't any town you can go to on the earth and go see Jesus and talk to him. But for them, having seen him enter into Jerusalem triumphantly, expecting that he's the Messiah, I think the expectation that they have is that surely these things are about to happen very quickly. And a very large part of what the Olivet Discourse is all about is dealing with that perception, I think. And essentially, if we were to step back and look at what is the answer that he gives them, the answer that he gives them is the destruction of Jerusalem that I have described, the destruction of the temple, that's going to happen within a generation, which is what happened. My return, however, and the coming of the kingdom, the Son of Man coming to in judgment and to gather up his people, nobody knows when that's going to happen. In fact, as he says, I don't even know when that's going to happen. And so, in essence, what he's saying is the destruction that I have predicted, and which is a sign of the ultimate coming of the Son of Man, that's going to happen soon. But you have to be prepared, and all of my followers have to be prepared for a very long period of time before the Messiah ultimately returns. In fact, in the parable of the virgins, the ten maidens, the problem that you see there is five of them didn't take enough oil to last out the night. They weren't prepared for the fact that he might be a long time in coming. What he's trying to accomplish here for his disciples is to say, the things that I have predicted are going to happen, and I am going to return, and when you see the destruction of the city the way I have predicted, then you need to recognize that what I predicted would happen did happen, and it is a sign that I truly am going to come the way I said I was going to come. But as in terms of the question of when I'm going to come, I'm not telling you that. And in fact, you need to be prepared for it to be a very long time. That's how I understand the message of this section. So, what he needs to correct is their idea that that this was going to happen soon, precisely because there's a very important spiritual dilemma that they have to face. And that's what those parables are about, that if the king goes away and doesn't come back for a long time, where does that leave me? What am I supposed to do about that? And that's what those parables are about, essentially to say what you need to do is to wait patiently, to persevere, to expect him to return at any time, but be prepared for him to be a long time. I mean, and that's essentially what he's getting at. Roger?
Question. In verse 14, it says, this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations and then the end will come.
Yes.
Is that in the destruction of the temple in 70 AD? And my second question is, did people heed his warning? Did they split and they saw the abomination of desolation? What's the historical?
Okay. So question number one was verse 14, when it says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations, and then the end shall come. He's asking if that's the end, as in the destruction of the temple. And my answer at this point is, I don't think so. I think he means the end of the age. You'll notice their question, when will these things be, the destruction of the temple, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So I think that section, he's culminating it by saying, look, you need to be prepared for such a long period of time that the gospel is going to go out to all the nations of the earth. That's how long a period of time we're talking about. And it is only after that has happened that the end is going to come. So the end, in terms of the end of the age that they're asking about, is not about to happen in the next week, because the gospel has to be preached to all the nations, and they didn't have TV or anything like that. So we're talking about, obviously, an extended period of time before that would be. That's how I would look at it right now. And your second question was, did people heed the warning and get out of Jerusalem when they saw that the Romans were coming? My understanding is that the Christians, in fact, did do that very thing, that they had been prepared for this eventuality by what Jesus had said, and actually heeded his warning and left. I'm not sure how I know that. That's one of those things that floats around that I've heard in various places, that I've never really had anybody point me to some historical documentation that was the case. So I don't know where that is, how we would know that, or how reliable it is, but that is what I've heard. Well, We are not done, so I want to finish talking about this next week. As he gets towards the end and into those parables, there's more of a... You have to understand that part of his purpose is informational here, and I'm trying to get the information across to you as best I understand it. And partly we're trying to deal with what I think is a misunderstanding of this passage and a teaching that has created a certain expectation about the future that I don't think is justified. But part of it is Jesus' purpose here is very pastoral. I mean, he recognizes the problem that it is going to represent for his people, that he's going to be gone and that all this stuff is going to be happening the way he's describing. And he's trying to prepare them for that eventuality. That being the case, that part of his teaching is just as relevant to us, because we're still living in that time when the king is gone, and we have to be prepared for that fact. Margaret?
Is the passage about the sun being dark and the moon night giver light, and then immediately after, is that in this passage here?
Yes, yes.
Are you going to deal with that next week?
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so we'll take on the rest of 24, hopefully finish that next time. And